Accession number 32527, Reel 3.
Robert Jaffer, Reel 3. You've just completed your course and you are moving on. What happened next?
And then they changed us then from RAMC to Ordnance Corps. And after a while, they formed REMI, you know, Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, and they transferred us to that, you see. And after the course finished, they actually asked us where we wanted to go to be posted to. And they gave us a list of the workshops, you know, where they were. And the nearest to my home was Bristol, so I said, I'll go to Bristol. So I went down to Bristol. And the system there was, you joined the workshops, which was everything, you know, and the radar was just a small section. Only about 8 or 9 people, you see, with an officer in charge. But you could get everything done, made there from a hairpin to a tank, you know, everything you could get done. And anyway, and the system was, they sent you out on the gun sites just to look after the radar. That's all you did. You serviced it, you repaired it if it went wrong. And we were only attached, this was the best part of it, for discipline and rations, which meant behave yourself and we'll feed you. Because they were all artillery and we were the only REMI. And we were quite independent. We were dependent to an officer who was in charge of 30 miles away, you see, because it covered a big area. That workshop covered from Land's End to Bournemouth and up to up as far as Cheltenham and Gloucester, you know, and all Bristol area. So we used to be sent out on the site, you see, and it was really marvellous. We had to do our maintenance, and we had a job to do. We had to keep the set working, but we weren't hardly subject to army discipline at all. That was a wonderful life. And what's more, we were doing a job that was worth doing, a job worth doing, and one we were interested in. And I liked that very much. But then, what I could not stand, I hated, was army life in barracks, you know. Oh, dear me, I must have been an awful soldier. I didn't want to be there, so that I didn't want to be in workshops. I could have been in workshops if I wanted to be, but I wanted to get out on the sites where you were independent and had a good time and all that. And so that life was very, very pleasant.
Did you manage to get off the site and socialise?
Oh, yeah. Good. I came and went as I liked.
And did you meet any young ladies at the dances and things?
Oh, yes, we did, but I wasn't very interested. Not that, actually, a couple of years later, I met my wife on the side. But anyway... what they would do was, they would occasionally, they'd keep on sending you on courses. The point was that radar was developing very fast, and you'd get trained on one set, and before you'd finish the training, it was obsolete practically, you know. In fact, there was one set, the 3B, that was made, and I don't think it was ever used, because the new American set came in then, and so you were always being sent on courses, and it was always the technical colleges I went to, or the factories. I went to HMV for 3 months. I went to BTH in Leicester, you know, British Thomson Tools, the electrical firms and all this. And the makers, the people who made the sets and the designers used to lecture us, you see. It was hard work, but it was a good job. We were doing something worth doing, you see. And apart from that, we were always in civilian business. I mean, we used to more or less live at Leicester Technical College.
So what do you find the conditions like in civilian billets for...
Oh, we were always in civilian wars. It was very. The civilians were very good, very, very good. You behaved yourself.
Yes.
And they were very, very good to us. Wherever we went, it was the same.
And did you find the food rations difficult?
Find what?
Food rations difficult.
Oh, the army supplied it. Supplied them the food rations. No, we were well fed in the army. No doubt about it. The best place. In fact, it's the safest place to be in the war. Was the army. But, I mean, London got it terrible. And, I always wanted to go on, I was always badgering them to go on site, on courses, because I didn't want to end up in workshops, you see. And I spent most of my time I was on courses. I'd come off a course, I walked in the office and say, when's the next course? You see? And I got them so trained that whenever an order came from the War Office to send somebody, one of their mechanics, on a course, the first chap that they thought of was Jaffa, you see, because I asked so much about it, because I didn't. And I was sent on one course, because, you see, there was no question of promotion at all, because it was not as well, I didn't want it then anyway. And I was sent on a course to Bury, you know, just north of Manchester. I think they only sent me because they didn't know what to do with me. It was sent me on a month's course to learn how to use tools, you see. And it was very, very good. They taught me everything. I could use a huge lathe before I'd finished and all that. And one of the passing out tests was to join a cable with 18 cores in it and a strain wire of steel through the middle, you see. That was difficult then, because when you join them all up and everything, you only had sort of liquid rubber to sort of build up around it, like the old plumbers used to do with the lead piping, you know. Well, I don't know whether it was accident or whether I was really good at it. I don't think I was. But my passing out one was put in the glass case on display this is how it should be done, you see. Well, I didn't think much of that. I think it was more luck than judgment, you see. And anyway, after a day or so, the bosses came along and said, look, if you'd like to transfer to instruments, we'll send you on a staff sergeant's course. I said, no, well, radar, who wants to do instruments? We did instruments anyway as part of the radar course, you know, because we had all the meters to look after and everything like that. And I turned it down. I don't know why I never applied for a staff sergeant's course on the radar. But I never even thought of it, because I was a class one mechanic by this time, which is as high as you could go. Well, anyway, I came away from there. And where did I go from there? Oh, yes, what happened then was I went back to my workshops, and it was just before the invasion. And I thought, oh, Lord, my class one mechanic is down. Well, they're not going to waste me when the chips are down. And sure enough, I was sent to, they were forming up units, you know, for it. And I was out between Cheltenham and Gloucester. What's the name of the place? It's a famous little place. Anyway, I had a gun sight there, and that's where I met my wife, actually. And we did all right there. But I was called in just before the invasion, about a week or so before the invasion, said, posted this workshops, and they said, well, we knew what we were doing. Well, we were going to, they were first workshop ashore when they landed in Normandy. I didn't like that idea at all, you see. But sure enough, one morning I came over the loudspeaker, Craftsman Jaffa, report to the office, and I reported to the office, and they didn't say a word. They just gave me, push a travel warrant in front of me with instructions to report to the military police in Leicester, the Leicester station. So I thought, that's fine, I'm off the invasion now. And I was. And what had happened was the doodlebugs had started, you see, and we had no real defence against the doodlebug, not when it started. And the radar wasn't good enough. That's what it worked about. It was developing all the time, but it wasn't good enough for low-flying, fast aircraft, you see. But when the Americans came in the war, we sent all our boffins over there, because it worked with the Americans, and they produced a set which was just coming into the country. And there were only two in the country at this time. One was sent to number one radar school in Kent somewhere. Don't know where that was, never went there. And I was sent to number two radar school at some little place about 15 miles west of Leicester. What's it called? Twy Cross. Never been there since. And we didn't know what we were doing. We arrived at Leicester Station, and we were there, sort of reported to the Red Caps, and waited, and four or five other fellas came along, and then they took us in a covered truck. And they took us out to this place, Twy Cross, which was a very nice place, big country house there. The gates clang behind us, you know. But the only thing to start, we took the oath, you know.
Secrets.
Act, what is it? The Secrets Act,
Secrets Act, yes.
Oh, did that, you know, what are we here for, sort of stuff. Then they called us together and said, now, we've got a new set, and we need it for the doodlebugs. It's very good. You've got a month to learn it. The Americans, it's an American set, you see, the Americans had 2 years. You've got to do it in a month. And they said, we are going to work you very hard, and if you have a nervous breakdown, we don't mind, we'll send you back to your unit. It won't be any fault of yours, and we'll get somebody else to do it, you see. But, of course, that was the urge to get cracking. And they worked us like mad. We did get Sunday off. We started at 8 o'clock in the morning and finished at 5 o'clock at night with an hour's break for lunch, you know. And it was tremendous course. I never thought we could do it. Anyway, we spent the month and passed it down, and then I was sent down to Kent to a workshops which governed the doodlebugs were coming in there. And the main defence against the doodlebug was on Romney Marshes. Do you know it?
No, I didn't know that, no.
Down by Hythe. Romney Marshes, Dymchurch Way, and things like that. It's still there. I went there. Hythe is the nearest down there. And I went down there, and I have never seen so many guns in my life. I'm not exaggerating. There must have been 1,000 heavy guns.
Goodness.
Plus everything. And these doodlebugs used to come in low at about 400 or 500 feet, you know, 400 miles an hour. Well, they were a knack-hack gunner's dream, really, because they flew straight. They didn't take evasive action, you know, and they didn't reply. So this was great. I was on this course there, and these things used to come up, and by Jove, it was... And they blew up. They were a 100,000-pound bomb, and they didn't half blow up when they blew up. But we were getting, actually, by this time, they said 97%, which was very high.
Excellent.
Because before, they were only getting 3% with the old radar, you know. But now, when this new radar, everything was automatic. You pick the target up on the radar, which we picked it up when it was fired in France. Had plenty of time to do it. The Air Force had the right to within a mile of the coast. When they reached the coast, they had to give up at a mile and leave it to the guns, because we were really, for the first time ever, ACAC was any good. It was just a morale booster before that. They just fired, and if they hit anything, it was because it got in the way, you see. And they got, and of course it didn't half come over. One night we fired 400 rounds it was midsummer. It wasn't dark till gone 10 o'clock, and it was lighted to 4 o'clock in the morning, and we fired 400 rounds in one night.
Goodness me.
But it was terrific, really, it really was. And I think on average, I saw it the other night on television, they shot down 67% of the doodlebugs. But you see, for the first month before they got the sets in from America, because they only had two in when I went on the course, they were the first two in. They were using the old radar. It was hopeless. Mm-hmm. I think they only got something about 3%. So overall, they said it went 67%. But we were very keen, of course, because we were saving London. And do you know our biggest enemy? The RAF. They would not. They had it to a mile within the coastline. They were absolutely useless. Because you could fill them with bullets, and then you couldn't. You had to upset the gyroscopic control, you know, because they weren't manned, you see. And the only thing you could do, a shell was the only thing that would blow them up. So we were very successful with the Air Force, despite all this stuff, all that tripe about tipping the wings of it. You've heard of that.
Mm,
a
yes.
Lot of rubbish. They'd have crashed themselves if they'd done that. Mm. They couldn't do that. The damn doodlebugs were faster than the fighters were, anyway. And that was just propaganda. But we did very well against them. And that's really where the war ended. No, it didn't. I went after that. Am I going too much?
No, not at all.
When that ended, I was sent abroad to the continent.
What time would have this been?
This would be 6 months. This would be October after the invasion of
October 44.
4 months later, you see. I was there for about 4 months. But just to show you how well trained we were as soldiers. I'd been in the RAMC and done no military training. I'd been transferred to all these different things and still no military training. And then when it came to it, I was on this doodlebug site, which is more or less, it was closed down more or less, so the doodlebugs were over. And I got an order from workshops one day, 3 days leave and you're going to France. You know, well, they didn't tell me I was going, I knew how it was. I guess so I had a day to get home, a day at home, and a day to get back to Harwich from Torquay, you see. So I went across there and I joined a workshop down there. God, it was a cold winter, that winter was.
Whereabouts in France were you?
We landed at Ostend. Mm. And we were around, we went to stay in Antwerp for a while, and we were up and on just inside Belgium most of that, for that winter, you know, for the remainder of that winter. It was very cold because nothing much was doing. I learned to drive there. Marvellous way. Do you know how I learned to drive? 2 o'clock in the morning, and a request came in for a radio mechanic up at the line was wanted because the radar had been damaged or something, you see. So they rigged me out, dished me out at 2 o'clock in the morning. Of course, I couldn't drive. And they'd no drivers. All the drivers were out. In fact, it was a very busy night, you see, and all the drivers were out. So I was told where I had to go and given a map reference. And I hadn't come drive. I said, well, he said, well, you take the, we had little vans rigged up as workshops, you know, he said, take that one. I said, but I can't drive. He says, you can't drive. I said, no. He says, come in the office, I'll give you a driving license. So I went in the office, and he wrote me out a driving license at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I had to go 15 miles up into Holland, on the Canadian sector, this was, you see, and I couldn't drive. And of course, I tried, and eventually I got it going, and I stumbled, and I got the hang of it in the end, but it's a four-wheel drive in those days. And on the way up there, it was about 15 miles I had to go.
What did you? Were you driving a Jeep? Or?
No, we had a little truck that was fitted out as a workshop.
Oh, yes.
A small van, you see.
Yes.
And it was Canadian Chev.
Oh, Chevy, yes.
And whilst I was there, when I was halfway up, I came across a convoy that was parked, was going up the front, and it was parked with trees on the sides here at night along the road. So I pulled out to pass it. Of course, I found out how to get it going. Well, I suppose I had an idea beforehand, and I got it going, and it was going along more or less like a kangaroo. Anyway, and I met a convoy coming the other side whilst I was passing this, because I had to stop. So I stopped. And when it came to start, I couldn't start again. Because I didn't realise a Canadian Chev, it had to you had to rev it very hard before it would fire. On an ordinary car, you just turn it and press it, starts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But theirs didn't, and I didn't know that. You see? And neither did all the fellows who helped me. And they all thought it was a fault on the car, on the truck. Oh, I didn't tell them that I couldn't drive. You see? And I reckon I did a good job for the Germans that night. I held up that convoy for well over an hour. And eventually they got me out of the way, got me pushed out of the way or pulled out of the way. And I got there in the end. But I reckon that night I was a great asset to the German army. They were clearing the Scheldt estuary, the Canadians were on it. And when I got there, the damn thing had been hit by a shell, and it didn't need me, it needed a demolition unit when I came back. But that's the way I learned to drive. But we did a bit of good out there. Not as good as we did in England, you know. Because, the war was nearly over then.
Were you involved with trying to...
Pardon?
Were you involved with trying to detect the V2s and 3s, which were starting to come over later in the war, weren't they?
We were still working, yes, we were still working. There wasn't much... Actually, there wasn't much German Air Force left by then.
So you were based in Belgium, really?
Yeah, in Belgium. Outside Antwerp,
we were.
And then in the spring, the Battle of the Bulge started.
Yes, I'd say nothing much moved, did it? Nothing much moved that winter, did it?
No, till then.
After Arnhem, and then the Battle of the Bulge.
And the German Air Force hardly existed. I don't think it did exist at all, but what was down there. So they sent us down there as a radar group, you see.
Yeah.
Sent us down there to back up the Americans.
Yes, well, the Bastogne area.
Liège, it was near Liège.
Oh, near Liège, yes, I know.
Yeah.
Yes.
And just to show you what I was going to tell you before, on my military experience, I transferred from REMC to REOC, Ordnance Corps, that is, then into REME, Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. Nobody ever thought of teaching me how to use weapons at all, you see. And when I came back from leave, that I told you, and joined this unit, they gave us new rifles. And they were just out of their package. They were full of grease. And it was about midnight when we got these things. And we knew we were going at 4 o'clock in the morning, so we thought we were all right. We'll keep it like that. But of course, at 3 o'clock in the morning, they got us out and gave us 3 rounds each, sent us on an indoor range, it was, to fire them. Well, I couldn't even get the pull through down through my rifle. I'd never fired a rifle. Didn't know how to, you see. Anyway, I couldn't get my pull through down it. And in my stupidity, I fired that rifle when it was full of grease, when the barrel was full of grease. It might have blown up. It didn't. But of course, I couldn't find my. It wasn't that I missed the target, because I couldn't find where the shots had gone, you see. So I thought, well, that's good military training, isn't it? That'd be a lot of use if it comes to any fighting. So anyway, nothing happened. We went to various places, you know, and we were sent down to down by the 8. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, the alarm went, you see, so we all traipsed out, you see, lined up. It's only about 100 of us, the most, not that. And the officer in command, he said, well, the Germans have broken through the American lines. And we were on the main road to Brussels, you see. And they said, they're making for Brussels. There is nothing between them and Brussels except you. So you're frontline troops now, you see. Oh, God. This is true. So they lined us up and they started. We were on an airport, an airfield that had been bombed to hell, you know. But we take over one of the sheds as workshops and everything. So we were... it had been fortified, so they lined us all up, and they gave us the option. The NC came to me and said, well, Jeffrey, you take the Lewis gun, which is a First World War gun, mind you, and go to the sandbagging placement at the entrance, you see, with so-and-so, with this gun. I said, I've never seen a Lewis gun, sir. Never, leave alone, find one. Oh, he said. Oh, well, he says, well, take the Bren gun and go to so-and-so. I said, well, I said... Yes, I said, no, what a red gun is. I said, well, I never fired it. Oh, he says, well, take the Piat gun, which is a bomb, anti-tank, bomb-throwing thing. Useless thing, but never mind, you see. I said, what's a Piat gun? He says, Jaffa, what military training have you done? I said, none. I said, being the RAMC all this time, and nobody's training. He says, look, take your rifle and get lost. And that's how I thought. And that's it. I spent the night wandering around this airfield with a rifle. He said, just take your rifle and get lost. Oh, and about this rifle. When I joined the workshops, I thought, well, I might not have been very good at shooting as I'd never fired a rifle before. And when we, you know, gave us the shots to sort it out. And I thought, I can't be that bad. So I took it to the armourer and I said, well, check this rifle. So when I got it back later in the day, he said, do you get rid of that rifle? He said, it's no damn good. I said, why? He said, well, he said, I can't zero it because I've got to send it so far, it's so inaccurate that the foresight, I'd be right off the barrel if to line it up. He said, it's useless. Nothing you can do with it. I did get it changed. I don't know why. They wouldn't change it for me, but I got it changed in the end. So that was my bit towards the war then. But isn't it terrible that you're 5 years in an army, 5 or 6 years in an army, and you don't even never even shown how to use a rifle?
Slipped through the net somewhere.
But
you slipped through the net.
No, none of the unit did. The German army, they used to train their RAMC in weapons, but they didn't arm them in action. But then I was very lucky, you see, because I stayed in Germany. We ended up in Hamburg. And, I enjoyed it. It was nice. Well, I liked it from the time I left the RAMC because we had a job to do. It was a job worth doing, you know. And best of all, it was a defensive job. We were protecting cities and things like that, you know. And you were doing some good. But so I enjoyed that. But I didn't, anyway, and I was demobbed from Hamburg when I left the army.
So when you, after the scare at Liège...
No, nothing happened.
No.
And they never came.
No.
You know what they were after? We knew it was there, but the penny didn't drop. There was a big American petrol dump just off the main road. And I'd been through this, doing other little jobs. We had to do telephones and things like that, you know. And I'd been through this place, and there were thousands and thousands of jerry cans all stacked up. Big as a block of flats, you know, dozens of them. And of course they were after that because they were short of petrol. And they, when they crossed, I think it's, now I'm not sure of the accuracy of this, but I was told that as they crossed the river at Liège, there was the main road to Brussels, but the this petrol dump was just on a side turning, which they missed and went past it. And they ran out of petrol. That's why they never came. They ran out of petrol.
Yes, the tanks were desperate and ran out, didn't they?
Yeah. We didn't know that till afterwards. They told us that afterwards. But all through the war, if I was coming, Jerry had just left. And if he was coming, I'd just left. Now and again, we missed time things, but we soon sorted that out. But the army was a waste of time. That was the trouble. And it wasn't until I spent 3 years, and nearly 2.5 years in the army actually, that I got out of the RMC, because it was a dreadful unit. Mm. Mind you, when I got out of it, the rest of the army I found was pretty efficient. They didn't, you weren't messed around, you know.
So after they crossed the Rhine in the spring of 45, you followed behind?
We went from there to, actually, we went from there to, what's the port in North Germany? First port of in Germany. I can't remember the name.
Not Rotterdam, no.
Not Rotterdam, before long, Rotterdam's Holland.
Hamburg?
No, further on than that. It's a double barrel name. Okay, what is it? I don't think it exists.
Warnemünde?
Where?
Warnemünde?
No.
In the Balkans? Baltic?
Oh, no, it's not that far. No. It's just inside Germany. Just inside Germany. Anyway, it doesn't matter what the name is.
Kiel?
No. Oh, my memory's going something. Memory for names is going. Anyway, I think the British Army was exceedingly well behaved. I only saw one, what you would call, bad behaviour, cruel behaviour, but that was excuse. We were at this place, and it was outside the city. We always wanted to get undercover, you see, because it couldn't work, really, from lorries. We had it all in the lorries, and you couldn't work from the lorries. We always got undercover, and the only cover we could get in the whole of the city was 5 miles out, where there was a big Nazi sports arena. And we took underneath the grandstand, you see. And we used to go into the main thing was they'd herded up all the authorities in the town, you know, and prisoners and everything, and put them in the, made a prison camp of the sports ground, you see. And when we went there, we had a lot of cleaning up to do, and they said, well, go in and get some help, you know, get some sort of help. And I went round there one day, and there was a British soldier, or a group of British soldiers, one in particular, doing a performance, and they'd got a man up against the wire fence and got his arms tied out like that. And they were bringing a cup of water to his lips and dropping it just when he wanted it, you know. And I thought, that's a terrible way to treat anybody, you know. Because it was a terrible camp, because there were about 10 or 11 murders every night in that camp. But there were thousands of people in there, everything, from Poles and Jews, and the Poles were murdering the Germans and God knows what. But anyway, and I wasn't content. I tried to sort of interfere a bit, and they threatened to beat me up. And I thought, well, frightened lots of this, as you see. So I went to one of the officers, and we had an officer in charge of the transport section, you know, in the workshop. And boy, he was a man. they were first rate. I've seen them in action, rescuing tanks that had got stuck and things like that. But he was a man. So I went up to him and I told him what happened. And I said, I think somebody should stop that. So we went along. And he came up to me afterwards. He says, don't take that any further. He says, I've stopped it. He said, it won't happen. I said, well, why? Why do people act like that? He says, they'd been fighting in the city for 3 days. They were pulled out an hour or so earlier to get to this place and to give them a rest. And he said, they'd lost their friends, seen their friends killed. And they'd been fighting for 3 or 4 days, you know. And he said, they were suffering from battle fatigue. So he says, just let it go. So it is. But I was there. But I had this job when we got there. This is where the armistice was. What's the name of this wretched port? I can't remember it. Yes. So whilst we were there, we moved in and we took it underneath the grandstand, you see, and it was in a dreadful mess. Muggins, of course, was told to get that cleaned up, you see. But we hadn't got the men. They said, well, there's plenty of men in, there's plenty of help, you can get one of the prisoners in this compound. So I went in there, you see, and I didn't like it at all. There must have been 10,000 people in there at least, you know,